So in case that wasn't clear, I'm going to be showing you guys how to use GitHub and Git in the context of, doing this project. This is by no means a definitive, this is how you do things. This is my preferred development setup when you don't really trust your teammates. And as students, you shouldn't trust your teammates at all. It's fair. Really? Actually, show of hands, how many people have used version control before? How many people have worked on a group coding project before? How many people have broken the build? Anyone who doesn't have their hands up is a liar. Everyone has broken the build, at least locally. so let's just dive right into this. So this is GitHub. I haven't gone to any special page. This is just showed up when you log in. On the right, you'll see every repository that you have under your account. There's some Simon's repositories.
Does everyone know your name?
What?
Does everyone know your name?
Oh, hi, I'm Alexei Beingesner. I'm one of your TAs. So newsfeed on recent stuff, repositories on the right. Right away you're going to want to jump to change your context, which will be the class. So now I see all of the classes' repositories because I'm God. You'll only see your own repositories, and I also see what everyone is doing in the class. So this is my demo repo that I created. This is exactly what you guys basically have. I've given it the default node git ignore and a readme. That's about it. I haven't done anything to it. So right off the bat, you're going to want to fork it. Fork to myself. Do some hard forking action, to quote GitHub. There we go. So now it's forked to me. And if I look at the tree, which probably won't load in a reasonable amount of time because this network connection is terrible. Whatever. Take my word for it. This is a separate repository now. This connection is... Yeah, definitely. I assumed the Wi-Fi would be fine in here. Yes, I'm the
editor. As everyone's on Wi-Fi right now, don't be checking all your email at the same time.
Yeah, don't torrent, please. Load? Man, this is just really broken.
Actually, hold on one second. Maybe
everyone in the room, disconnect your Wi-Fi.
Before I'm going to set mine. You want a tether? That might be better.
Wait, what?
You want a tether?
Wouldn't that be worse?
No.
Well, then, what are you tethering from?
LTE.
LTE, exactly.
Oh.
Eh. Okay. Okay. So now you should be able to find mine. You need to check the password here. It's not showing anymore? No, Eduroam will normally be fast.
Oh, you have an Ethernet cable?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'll take that. That works. Even better.
Oh man, I loaded the no CSS version.
Ooh.
Nice.
What?
Oh, neat. Where's my Ethernet today? Where's the... Mm. This, presumably?
Yep.
Is that doing anything?
Any demo has to have at least one glitch.
Yeah. Internet?
Just disconnect from. Just disconnect from. Just try it now.
Oh, I see your iPhone.
Okay, I just disconnected.
Wired connection. There we go.
There we go. Great, go.
Stop trying to stop that. Okay, there we go. Oh, that's much better. Okay. So the first thing you're going to want to do is copy this. I guess it's a URL. It's an SSH type thing. It's basically a pointer to your
whole repo.
Cover
SSH setup.
There's a lot of good tutorials for that. You also don't actually need to set up SSH at all. It'll just prompt you for a username and password every time if you don't. So ideally, you should set up an SSH key just for A, security, and B, save you time, but you don't need to at all. I have. So very first thing you always do in a new project is git clone, and the URL path resource thing that you copy here. So now it's downloading the whole thing down to my computer. My file system, it's already created the folder, and it's copied everything down. So in Unixy things, everything prefixed with a dot is hidden. So there's two secret files that git creates. There's this .git folder that holds a bunch of metadata. Generally, you don't care about this. Don't touch it. Unless you're really good at Git and you can like set up hooks and stuff, don't go in here.
But note it's big.
Yes.
It holds an entire copy of your repository and all the history.
There's also this .gitignore.
Does that mean that if it got fork out of this 52 repos, it'll contain the history of all of that? Or?
It'll contain as much history as you cloned. Because it's literally a clone. You're cloning whichever one you found. It won't necessarily know about someone else who has forked off you, unless they've merged back in.
All the initial repositories are all top-level, brand-new, empty repositories,
yeah.
So you won't have anything from anyone else's.
So the .gitignore file, it's just basically a line-delimited set of regular expressions, and it's things that it will refuse to commit unless you really, really try. So by default, the node one is it won't get log files, dat files, CSVs, output files, PIDs, targizzes, bunch of stuff, and the npm debug log.
Are these regular expressions or glob patterns?
Glob patterns.
I think they're glob patterns. Yeah.
Because dot is actually just dot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're pretty close. Not many people know what a glob pattern is.
You might want to talk about it. Who here has used regular expressions?
Okay, so no one knows either of these.
Okay, globbing patterns? Okay, topics to cover.
It's not really important. They'll always get at dot anyway.
No. Okay. we should cover regular expressions at some point because you need them for JavaScript.
Kind of. But anyway, yeah, so this is what it's with. This is the readme.md. This will change what shows up if someone visits your GitHub page. Markdown, who's posted on Reddit, Stack Exchange, or Stack Overflow? That's Markdown. It's really intuitive. It's basically how you would write an email. That's the whole point of it. But the spec is terrible because it's some guy's blog post and a Perl script, which has bugs.
There's some alternative
out there. Oh yeah, there's tons of different implementations, but there's no like spec.
They're trying to have two.
They're trying. But anyway, so what did I have? Git clone.
So you first forked it in the repository.
Yeah.
Then you cloned it to your local machine by running git clone.
So my recommended pattern here. Is to have a repository I call Mothership. And that is the central repository. In SVN, this would be the repository. And then everyone forks it into their own. So GitHub accounts. And then everyone just pulls down to their own local computers.
I could have just cloned the mothership to my local machine, right?
Yes. But generally, I don't recommend directly talking to mothership when you don't trust each other. Because then you might just break it. Whereas I'm going to recommend a pattern that is more safe.
So commits will go to your forked version.
Yes. And then you submit pull requests. While everyone could theoretically push to mothership, don't. Because you're going to break something and everyone's going to be mad at you. And it's hard to undo things once they've been done. So, back to GitHub. So this is what I'm calling fork. And I can see it says right here, forked from here. So let's go back home. And this is where you guys will be managing all your issues. So there's issues and milestones. So right now I'll create a new milestone. And I don't know, it's due on Saturday. So now if I go to create a new issue, we need an index.html. I guess it's a bug, sure. Any good web app needs an index.html. It's a bug if there isn't one. So I'm going to assign it to the it works milestone because that's it needs an index.html to work, at least in my design. I'm not even necessarily making a node app right now. I'm just making some stuff. but yeah, so we need one. Submit new issue. So if I go back to issues, there it is. So now I'm going to go in. Oh yeah, I can do this. Comment. And assign it to myself. Oh, I can assign it to you too.
Everyone can assign, you know, to the owners, I guess.
Oh yeah, fun.
It'll be your fault.
So now I've taken claim of this issue. This isn't necessary. This is just kind of a good communication workflow to do. Theoretically, I wouldn't be the one who created and assigned it to myself. But yeah. So now I'm going to go back here and go, you know, create a new document. That's not the default open operation. Can barely remember the syntax for this. I think that's right.
Yeah. You can just make it a text file and browse will be built. This will eventually be a web page. Yeah.
I guess you can submit another issue.
Yeah. That's actually in my doc. That's vaguely.
Are you outside of your body? You're putting stuff.
HTML head. No, this is right.
Okay.
This is the most bare bones index.html I could possibly write. I guess I could make a crappier one.
Some extra new lines in there.
Yeah, those are fine. That's coding style.
Yeah.
but sure, I could add a new line here too. So yeah, so that's all good and fine, but no one actually has that. So right now I need to go. So right now I can look at git status to tell me what's up. Need to go into. So once your terminal is actually in the directory. So git status, I have an untracked file index.html. That means I have not. Git will completely ignore this file for the time being. It's not in the git ignore, it just does not care about it. And it's actually telling me what to do right now. I need to git add it. So by default, I always just git add dot, and dot is a pattern that matches every single file forever. So now if I git status again, it will say there's a new file, and that will be committed. So now if I want to actually commit it, git add just says, I'm interested in this file, commit it next time you want to commit. So there's a few things going on here. So git commit is the command to say I like this state, I want to save it. The minus a flag means it's basically the same as git add dot, but it won't add files that are untracked. So if you have only changed files that you're already tracking, the minus a will just catch them all.
But add dot said you're going to track everything.
So yes, add dot will track. Add dot adds everything and also adds files that you weren't tracking before. Whereas the minus a flag will just commit files that you are already tracking but have changed.
Right. No, but I'm saying is, but now everything in that directory from now on all time will
yeah.
be.
Yeah, so I don't actually need the minus a flag here, but it's reflex at this point. The M is for add a message, and that's what I'm adding here in quotes. Good issue syntax or message syntax is one very short and sweet line to summarize what you did, a blank line, and then a bunch of lines detailing what you did, if anyone cares. In GitHub, the first line will only show. You'll also note I put fixes number one. That's actually GitHub magic, saying that this is in reference to issue number one, which is the issue I created.
So just so you know, when he... does anyone know what the angle brackets are on the left side? Right, but that's because he has an open quote and didn't close it.
Actually, it's because I hit shift enter.
You hit shift enter?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you hit enter, it'll just be like, I don't know
what
this command
means. Yeah, it'll just vomit on me.
Doesn't Bash ask for... Oh, no, Bash...
Okay, let's try it without finishing the quote. Oh, it'll just let me keep going. Okay. So here it goes. I've added index.html, fixes number one, one file change, 10 insertions, create mode, blah, 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 blah. So if I check git status again... your branch is ahead of origin master by one commit, and there's nothing to commit at all. Everything is good. And if I check the log, I can actually see here's my commit, and here's the initial commit from...
You're pointing to your screen.
Yes, sorry. here's my commit with my message, my full message, and some metadata so you can know who actually did it. And there's the initial commit at the bottom from when GitHub created the repository. So now I actually want to get it, you know, back up. So I'm going to do... Oh, man, I forgot to branch. Dang. Oh, well. Actually, I can still get branch at this point.
Well, why don't you do a commit and then do this again with a branch?
What?
Hey, why don't you commit this one already and then you can do another branch and try it a little bit?
Yeah, I'm just going to move this over to a branch. So, git checkout minus b new index. So normally you don't want to actually work directly on the default branch, which is master, because that is supposed to be stable. And someone might make changes and you might want to pull it down and see how it works. And if you have crap in master, it might break their stuff. So generally I consider it good to always checkout minus b, which means checkout and create a new branch.
Could you show that on the diagram?
Yeah, sure. So this is kind of the big picture repository, but each of these is its own little tree. So right now we have a master. So like this has a little master branch, which we've just added this new commit, create index. And we're going to branch off into a new branch called new index, so that ideally when we pull down, our stuff won't conflict with theirs. So now we're going to continue on in a parallel development from this, and someone over here, Steve, we're Steve now, someone else could be working on it and pushing it up into here because you have two or three members. You might not even know what's going on in the repository because, I don't know, you don't care. So, yeah, we're going to continue on a parallel branch here. So switch to new branch, new index. And now we want to push this back up home. So git push origin new index. And origin is a reference to the repository we cloned from. So that's going to be this one, not this one, even though this is technically the ultimate origin. We don't care about that one from our local development perspective. So that's talking to the remote server. That'll take a while to think. Oh, there it goes. So we successfully pushed up new index to new index. And it actually noted it's a new branch because it's never heard of it.
So what you did was you created a new branch and then you committed the new branch. You pushed the new branch.
Yeah. So up in the original repo, it does not care. But if I go to... where is my stuff? God, this is terrible to look at. Ah, yes. So, if I go back to my repository,
you recently pushed Branch's new index.
So if I check out that branch, I can see that my new file is right here. Great. Now I want people to actually use my work, so I go to the top here and submit a pull request. And here it says, because I was in the new index branch, it knows that I want to push new index to their master. So it actually grabbed my commit message because it was the only one, so I'm actually fine with that message. And send a pull request. So here we are in the pull request that I just submitted. It looks exactly like an issue because it is exactly like an issue. And now, say I'm your teammate, I come in, see this, and I go, okay, what were the files changed? Okay, this is kind of stupid. Needs UTF-8 definition. Because you can't possibly not specify UTF-8. Because some archaic devices don't assume that. What's up?
What about the Windows encoding? Can we use that?
No.
Please don't.
So you can just comment on all their changes line by line. Nice and handy. And then I can be like, no, screw you. Fine, I'll fix it. After someone actually came up to me and just yelled at me. Now I look insane, but anyway. So I can't remember what the UTF-8 header is. Sure. Yeah, let's grab that. That looks about right. I don't remember. So now if I get status, I don't need a get add now, because it already cares about this file. But it won't necessarily commit it. It just says it was modified. So I do need to do the minus A this time to tell it commit all the files that could be committed. And that I've added already. So, fixing index header. I don't really need anything else because it's really that simple. And we'll get push again. This time I don't actually need to say origin new index because I've already created that branch. And origin is actually totally implicit. So, that'll do that. Yes, actually.
You might not want to do that, it's true.
It is pushing up my messed up master.
Yes.
But
that's okay because you're private.
Yeah.
That's why you forked off of the...
And usually it's nice to just get push everything up to your remote repo just as like an archiving process. You don't want to lose your local work. Although that's why I keep all of my Git artifacts in Dropbox. Because man, have I broken things. So now if I go back to all of the pull requests, we can see I've actually, the new commit that I just did is actually already added to the pull request. That's a contentious thing. Some people say that it should just stay at the commit you set, but GitHub will always do the head of that of the branch it was pointed to. So if you, that's another good reason to just stick to working on a separate branch from master, because if you pull stuff into master, it'll start getting pulled into your pull request and it'll be a whole mess. So generally you want to have a separate branch for each separate feature that you would want to have a separate pull request for. So now I go, this looks good, plus one, and now I say, okay, merge it in. Boom. So now if I go back to the demo repo, you'll notice that my issue is gone. So we need an index.html. Here it says, I closed this issue from a commit because because I said fixes number one. That's a magic keyword. If you just say this should fix the issue, it'll close it right away, so you don't even have to care.
Do you have to just say fix, or can you say other?
There's a few keywords. GitHub fixes keyword. That word is not on this page at all. Why did you bring me here, Google?
Integrated issue tracking.
That might be it. There we go. Close, closes, closed, fixes, or fixed. All of those right before the number sign and the number of the issue will close that issue. I prefer fixes just because that's the one I remember. So that's nice. Also, some other things you can do is I can go in here and say, great work at... Can I not ping myself? Okay. Somayaji. You really are doing it. So this will actually ping him up in his notifications up here. I highly recommend you check your notifications every day. Also, if you have an issue that you really want all of your group members to notice, you can be like, hey, at this guy's, if you're in that team, what's wrong with this?
Got a question.
Yeah.
So what exactly is a pull request?
So a pull request is basically, I have this branch, and I want to merge it into your branch. Normally a pull request is designed for when you actually don't have push access. But by this workflow, I give everyone push access so they can all accept pull requests. And it's basically a gentleman's agreement that I will only push by submitting pull requests. And ideally, you wouldn't accept your own pull requests. You'd have someone else look at your pull request and accept it.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So it's a bit weird in that I'm doing it all myself. But the basic workflow is I don't trust any of my teammates. I don't even trust myself. Someone needs to look at this code. It's called the review to commit model. It's a bit overkill for bigger projects, but for a tiny little project where there's not a lot of work going on, it's probably fine. And it's probably safer.
Trying to think of it as requesting the mothership to pull from you.
Yes.
You could push directly to the mothership. You have the privileges to do so. It's just that if you do it, you're potentially messing everything up.
Oh, and this is going to the mothership.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just submitted a pull request from my fork to the mothership.
To the mothership. Oh, okay.
Think of it this way. It's like Linus Torvalds having his own master copy of Linux. And what you do is you say, Linus, could you add this? So could you pull this from my Git repository and take it and add it to the master tree? And you're basically, instead of you just pushing directly to Linus's tree, because, well, he wouldn't be cool with that.
Yeah.
So, question. So, I know merge does pull and something else, right?
I think it's pull does merge and something else. Check out and merge.
Okay. So, the pull requests are queued, like, you would do a pull and then whoever logs in to look at the mothership repo would see a queue.
Yeah, pull requests show up as an issue in the repository.
Okay.
They actually get their own issue number. So if I go back to issues and look at the closed issues, here's my pull request. With the code attached, here's us arguing about it. So even if, like, say you're in a three-group team and two people do this and you go, oh, you broke everything, you can actually see their rationale, sort of, if they actually discussed it. Or he can just go, oh, you clearly didn't review this at all. Slap them on the wrist.
So I want to do a quick review. Like, how much was there more do you want to show? More?
Yes, I was going to simulate problems.
Okay, before we do that, I just want to step back. I'm kind of wondering how much the class has lost at this point. Okay, how many people feel like they understood basically everything he did?
is pretty good.
That's about 2/3 not
honest,
getting it.
The diagram, I think, is confusing me more than helping me.
Yeah. That's why I didn't want to do too many diagrams, because it's like there's trees inside trees, and
yeah,
it's a whole mess.
So, just for those of you feeling lost, the basic workflow of Git is simple in the sense of you have a repository that's on GitHub. You want to pull a copy of it to your local machine so you have your own copy of it. You make changes to it, and then you push it back.
See, here we can actually see what I did. So it's all been kind of hidden away now, but we see the original black is basically Mothership, and the blue is me.
Okay. So you see, that's what he's talking about, a branch coming off and pushing it back. But that's kind of a separate thing from what I'm talking about. Like, there's a master repository, you do a Git clone, you get your own copy of it, you make changes to it, and then you can push it back up to the master repository. What we're saying is don't push. Instead of pushing, because if you push things, you're saying, I'm going to change the repository. Instead, issue pull requests, which means I've made a local change, you should pull from it. And the easiest way to do pull requests is to have separate branches of the repository, because pulls only really make sense across branches from some main master repository. So you're doing some work in one branch. There's a master one, you branch off, you do your work, and then you say, pull from my copy, and then it all gets merged in. And you're branching basically to keep making more copies.
Yeah. So when you're actually doing real development, this is what it ends up looking like of the workflow. This all went off without a hitch at all. No conflicts, nothing. Maybe there were some conflicts, but people resolved it locally. That is the power of Git. When you have like 10 different people working on it randomly, merging it, pulling it, it was fine. Imagine doing that with Dropbox. You'd kill yourself.
No,
you're probably not getting this, but going down the chain. So let's say Steve changes the mothership.
Yes, I was about to do that.
So.
You're going to break something?
First, I'm just going to. So I'm done with the new index project concept. So if I do git branch, I can actually see all the branches. So there's master and new index. The star shows where I am.
Is master mothership?
Master is just a branch. If I want to see...
There's always a master branch.
You can actually delete the master branch.
You can. It's a default branch.
Yeah, it's the default branch. And generally, you should think of that as the stable release branch. Only thing that should be in there is things that you want to show your TA. So if I do git remote, that's origin. So remotes are these things, branches are these things.
So a branch is you're saying in your one repository, you're wanting to, in effect, make clones.
Yeah.
In your own repository, kind of basically saying that you want to work on three features, you in effect can work on them in three separate copies, but they're all branched off, so that way, and then you can merge them together later on.
So because of the tier where you've got the mothership, which is basically the repo that resides with whoever created the account for the course, and so we clone it, you're suggesting that everybody clones a separate, or forks
a
separate
repo. Everyone forks
their own.
So you're basically branching it. So what's the difference between forking that and branching it?
Fork is just a keyword. It basically means clone this repository to my own account.
But the key thing is that you're making a separate copy of the repository,
right,
as opposed to
just branching.
Right.
Yeah.
But that branch has happened within the same repository.
So when you're doing this system, if Mothership dies or Steve dies, you can still keep developing because you have a full copy.
Right. The question I had was, so when issuing pull requests to the Mothership, the assumption is that you will have obtained the latest copy or merged the latest mothership into your master.
You don't have
and
to
then
have.
Made sure
it will handle the merge for you if you have not. But ideally, you should merge in the latest mothership just to ensure that it builds.
Right.
But there is actually absolutely no restriction. The only time it will yell at you is if there would be a merge conflict if they were to accept that pull request. Then it will put up a big red banner of like, this will not work. You need to fix this.
Yeah.
I was about to do that, actually. So.
Well, I think you're just going to make changes.
Yes.
Simulating. Like amongst all the team, like bringing it together. I was just simulating like a master change.
I don't understand what you mean exactly.
When you did the pull, when he did the pull request, that was a master change. But
sorry. How do you mean? It's testing if the merge would fail or not.
Yeah. Oh.
There is a flag in Git that lets you basically try it without doing it, and it will tell you what would happen.
So far, you've only modified Steve, though, right? Not Mothership. Because when you
I have
it,
so.
That little diagram that you showed with the master was Steve. It wasn't Mothership.
Yeah. So, if we ignore my teammates, we'll go. Mothership. I forked to Steve. I cloned to local. So that's my computer. I did some stuff and I pushed back up to Steve. And then I sent a pull request back up to Mothership. That's the general workflow. And everyone's doing that on their own branch.
So pull request should be approved by
ideally. If your teammates are like dead, sure, accept your own pull request. But ideally have a gentleman's agreement that you should review each other's code. I like to have a sort of time limit of if you review it, we can pull it in right now. If no one reviews it for like a day or two, I'm just going to pull it in myself.
So all of that was clear except for the last part where everybody should do it on their own branch. Were you referring to
right.
Steve?
So
or were you
there's
to
Steve, Gankro, John. They all have their own forks,
right.
So they're all doing this own thing.
You weren't talking about branching off of the mothership and then basically creating a forking off of that branch and keep that going, were you?
I don't think so.
Well, no, just like on local, you would probably branch as you're working on different things.
Yeah, so local, I would create.
Well, that is the purpose of the branches of the local, is to say that,
right.
Let's say I'm working on three features, A, B, and C. Now, let's say A, B, and C could all interact. Instead of trying to work on all three, I mean, I could set up three clones of the repository, but they have three old copies of it, which could be rather large. Instead, I have three separate branches. I can switch between the branches like this. And then be working on coding them separately, and then I can merge them together once I have them debugged individually, and then I can try seeing how they interact.
Yeah. So
this is more accurately what I did. I forked off new index from my local master. So I guess master. I branched. I pushed new index up here, and then I pull requested new index into master.
Now, this is all, I mean, if this all feels a bit confusing, you need to play with Git. None of this will make sense completely until you actually
feel free
do
to
it.
Create your own random public repositories and smash them around for a few days.
Yeah, try to create your own issues, try to do things, tell your teammates, just play with it, break stuff, and then do something real.
Okay.
Last question. Under this proposed scheme, who would then be in charge of merging the branch that's sitting off of the mothership into mothership?
So this is master. I never branched off of mothership. Mothership always just had master.
So basically the mothership won't have any branches?
No. You
so
could give it branches
that?
If you wanted, but you don't need to.
Okay, so that extra little circle is confusing then.
So yeah, this is master, this is new index, this is new index, this is master.
So once the pull is accepted, the mothership is changed. And there's no more
nonsense. Yeah. But new index is still sitting here and here. I was actually about to go delete them. So let's.
And then everyone else pulls down the new mothership at their leisure.
Yes. If they want to get the new in order to get, how do you update from mothership? Changes are there. How do you get them down to your branch?
About to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
So here I've checked out. Check out master. Checkout is the command to jump between working branches. If I go back to my actual files now and go back to my index, oops. So my text editor is informing me that my file has changed. If I reload it, my header's gone, because that work was not in master. If I git checkout, wasn't letting me tab it. So I'm back on new index. If I go back to my text editor, it's changed again. So I can keep changing my files back and forth. And Dropbox is pissed off at me right now.
Notice how fast you can switch with Git. You can switch branches, and if it's just in a couple of, I mean, if it's like hundreds of files, it'll do it like that.
Oh yeah, it's like
is
butter.
Is it because it's just doing like soft links with things that are not Git?
No, it just turns out it's crazy optimized.
I just swapped out the hash for keeping track of the
No,
hashes.
You're getting entire new copies.
Yeah.
Dropbox,
I assure you, Dropbox is furious right now. So now I want to delete new index because I'm done with it. So that's just branch minus D. D is for delete because Git likes being clever like that. Error, it's not fully merged. Right. So it's actually angry at me because it thinks I'm deleting real work. So what I have to do is I want to actually add as a remote mothership so that I can pull down from it.
So what's a remote?
A remote is like mothership, Gangro Steve. It's the full repository. It's just anything that is not local. So if I go back to mothership, load, and I grab its SSH magic URL, git add mothership, and then its magic URL, and I go git branch. Git remote.
So we'll wrap this up in a couple minutes.
Yeah. So now I've added mothership, but origin is still my default. So now if I git pull mothership, come on, man. You can do it. There we go. You asked to pull from mothership but did not specify a branch, but the default error. Ah, jerk. Oh no, it pulled master. So now if I go back to this file, let's change. You sure?
Because you already pulled, didn't you have a pull request?
Yeah. So maybe let's just do git pull mothership master, just to be safe. It does get very angry when you do anything that isn't with origin and master. You need to be more explicit. There we go. Okay. So now it pulled down my changes to the index, and while I'm still on master, it's got this header. So now I can actually delete new index. And now it's like, okay, you've clearly merged in this work. It figured it all out because it's magic. So now new index is gone. So the git pull mothership master is how you get the work other people have done. If you get you're allowed to git push mothership master, but please don't, because that's how you break things. So there's that. And now I'm going to simulate breaking.
We're coming off 45 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. So
we
started at 1 and it's about 150 now. So
I was going to show them how to deal with a merge conflict, which I feel is kind of important.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Okay.
I was wondering how much more stunned people are. It's all good? People are okay?
So in GitHub, you can actually edit these, but also please don't. So let's say that my teammates worked behind my back and added foo to the body. Because they think that should be there. That's their decision. Meanwhile, I go, man, this should really have bar in it. Now I do git pull mothership master. It's going to pull it down and it is going to yell at me. Automatic merge failed. Fix conflicts and then commit the result. Now Git has butchered my file. So things have changed. Whoa! So here it's showing me what is there. So at the top is my local changes, and at the bottom is what someone else did. So I look at this, and you can use many automatic tools to properly parse this out into a more reasonable form, but I can just edit this text file too. So I go, oh, okay, we want barfu. That makes sense. And now I would submit a pull request on this. And here again is the issue with working in master, is whenever you pull down from mothership, you might break everything right away.
So you used to push, but you're not supposed to do a push. Right?
Push goes to origin by default, which is my fork.
Oh, right.
So it's perfectly fine for you to say git push, just don't say git push mothership master.
Mothership being the name of your repo.
Yeah,
your
well, the name I gave it.
Right, for them, instead of mothership, it would be what their team name is.
And finally, I might go just a quick little thing. I also go, I want Baz in here. And then I go, wait, crap, I don't want that. So say I want to pull from master again, but I have this crap on my master. I can just type git stash, and that will revert back to the last commit. So the stuff I did is gone. And if I want it back, I can just say git stash pop, and my work is back. You can also do something called a reset. That you'll see when you start Googling git because you got confused, you'll see two commands, reset and rebase. Those are the devil. They are valid commands, and they can be useful in very specific situations, but avoid ever using them. Because normally, when you want to use reset or rebase, you've broken something, and now you're just going to break it more. The stash, you mean? There is no staging command. What I did was...
You're kind of doing a staging by committing it to a separate, your own repository.
Yeah, when you
and
popped,
then
it basically looked at what you stashed and then said, okay,
yeah.
Now you're staged.
So the stash is basically, I made some changes. I don't really want to save these, but I don't really want to lose them either. So I'm just going to put this over here for now. It just saves the diffs so that they'll be reapplied, and it's a stack so you can just keep piling them up. Yes, you can. Do you have a question, or are you just stretching? Okay. That's the basics of a GitHub workflow. You do all this, and then finally, you pull back down. I'll be posting my notes up on the wiki so that people can see what I just did, see the commands. So.
Thanks a lot. Take a look.
Okay, so. What I want to talk about today after this, so we have some time now, is JavaScript objects and JavaScript functions. And going back to that first off, going back to the tutorial, what'd you all think of that blog example? Okay. So have you all, because a lot of you are asking, what should my application look like? What will it look like at the end? And I wanted to go ahead and give you this example because most of you do not have the background to understand all the bits and pieces of it. But the idea is that you don't have to understand all the bits and pieces. Here it is. Here's a framework. You could actually start mashing in code there now if you really wanted to. But here's a framework to start trying to understand what's going on. I strongly encourage you to understand things before you start hacking madly, because there's a lot to understand. And so over the next few weeks, I'm going to try to explain various bits and pieces of this. I'm not going to explain every little bit,
because you all are going to have to read some of this. Like, actually, right now, I assume that you all have JavaScript, the good parts. What we're going to be talking about today and Thursday is going to be chapters 3 through 5. So you should go read that. Chapters 1 and 2 are nice as introduction. Chapter 2 is all these syntax diagrams. I like those syntax diagrams, actually, when I'm first looking at a language, because it gives nice clarity about what the language is and what it isn't. So I encourage you to look through it, but if I were to walk through those, you'd want to shoot yourself. So look at the first two chapters, but my focus right now is in chapters 3 through 5. I'm going to be pulling various pieces from that to try to give you an understanding of what JavaScript is as a language. And the biggest thing you have to get your head around, I think, given what you've learned beforehand, is the fact that that JavaScript has no classes. There are none. So because normally when you say, okay, I have an object. An object is an instance of a class. And how do I understand what methods, variable, attributes and stuff. New is weird in JavaScript. New is potentially something you should never use in JavaScript unless you're really careful. I mean, it's a funny little keyword. I actually very much agree with the conclusion of Crawford. That's his name, right? Crawford's conclusion that they made JavaScript not have classes. Then they tried to give it syntax to make it look like it had classes.
That's dumb.
It's
marketing.
Yeah, but it makes the language much more confusing than it needs to be. It's actually much simpler than that. So I'm going to try to get at the simple part. Because really, especially if you think of it from an implementation perspective, JavaScript has a very simple mental model. And much of this, JavaScript is the first draft of a great language. But it is a first draft. What that means is they got lots of really good ideas, and then they made mistakes. And they never really got a chance to fix them. But the language is good enough, you can work around the blemishes very easily. But if you don't realize they're blemishes, you're just going to get confused. Which is part of the reason I have for picking this book. What?
Are you going to be recording the lecture?
It is recording. So, what does an object look like in JavaScript? First off, when you think about objects in a language like JavaScript, you have to think this is a dynamic language, which means I want to be able to redefine everything at runtime. Nothing is fixed in stone. There is no compile step. There is no taking the code, okay, this is what is compiling it, now this is the way the code is going to be structured. The structure of the code will change at any time during execution. It can rewrite its code on the fly. When you think of this, and you think of a notion like classes, you realize, wait, if I'm going to have classes around, that defines this very static way of defining an object. How do I change the class? When you start thinking about dynamically changing classes, you come up with a design like JavaScript. Because then you go like, wait, if I can dynamically change a class, how is a class really different from an object? It's really just a prototype for what an object is supposed to be. And that's what JavaScript is. It's a prototype-based object-oriented language. You have an object. You want to make other objects like it. You treat it as a prototype. You change the prototype, all the objects that inherit from it will automatically change in certain ways and not in other ways. And how that is part of understanding how JavaScript works. But the mechanism behind this is very simple. Everything is an object in JavaScript. So what is an object? It's just a curly braces, So this defines an object, and then you have properties. You have a property, and you have a value. So property 1, property 2, that's an object.
Anonymous.
Hmm?
Anonymous.
No, I'm thinking it could be. This is an object.
But is it an anonymous object? Given that
it's an object. It's, so the question is, what's the name of the object? I have to then give it a name. If I don't, this, an object by default is just this. If I want to be able to refer to it, I either use it in a context where I will have an object, or I can assign it a name. So I can say O equals this, and I have an object. This is now a name for this.
I think I'm supposed to have a semicolon here.
It's something, yes, sir.
You mean an object literal, right? A declaration of an object literal. Because an object also has a bunch of stuff going
in the scope. Okay, yeah, yes. Mm. No. I'm saying that you can think of it, I mean, this is a syntax for it, but this is an object. The question is, what are all the properties? When you create an object, there are the properties you specify explicitly, and there's properties that are specified implicitly. And this is where things get a little funny, is that what properties do you have when you have an object? You define it like this, okay, I think I know all the properties I put in there. In a language like Java or something, you kind of say, oh, this is the class, this is what, you know, you know, this is what all the attributes are of the object, this is what methods are, I know exactly what's there. That's not the case with JavaScript. And that's because of how things are referred to. So if you are trying to modify an object, you modify these, so if we say O dot prop 2 equals x, that will change this value. What if I want to create a property 3? How do I do that? Once I have an object, let's say I only define two properties, and I want to add a third property. How do I do it? I just assign it. I don't change any declaration, do any type, I just assign it. So, what if you try to access a property of an object that you haven't defined? Is it legal to do that?
Yes.
Completely legal. What's the value of that attribute? Undefined. You can refer to the to any property, basically, of an object. They all, in principle, exist. It just will tell you, well, what is it? Well, it's undefined. I don't know what it is. So that right there should be, when you start thinking about a language like Java, there is no, you know, compile time type checking error of saying this is an, you know, this object does not have a property of this. You, in your code, you have to check whether the return result is undefined. Because if it is undefined, it doesn't exist. It doesn't have a well-specified meaning. So, if this is what an object looks like, how are they related to each other? What's the relationship between them? Has anyone read ahead?
Prototype.
So, every object in JavaScript has a prototype property. It's always there. And you can set it explicitly, like any other, but it's going to be defined no matter what.
What about the object object? Does that have to
work? I think it's itself. I think it's a circular link. Yeah, so the prototype refers to another object of which is a prototype. And this is a chain. You know, this can be a prototype of another, another, all the way up to the master object. There's a global object. And that's where everything bottoms out.
So
No, one of the properties can be an object in its own.
Hmm?
One of the properties can be an object in its own.
The properties can refer to any valid JavaScript type, which includes objects.
And functions.
And functions. Functions are objects. So yeah, so this can refer to anything. You know, numbers, functions. Yeah.
And so they change dynamically, and if you've got an object called M or whatever that uses as its prototype O, and then you go ahead and you go O.prop49, then this other object that used O as a prototype.
Oh, okay, you're getting a little ahead of me. This is what I'm going to try talking about now. You have to, but yes,
okay.
I think you're going in the right way, but. So you have these objects, you have this prototype object. So what is this prototype object used for?
Prototype.
Yes, but what does that mean in this context?
Inheriting.
What's inheriting? But inheriting is a very funny thing. So all it is, all inheritance is in this context, is saying that if you access a property that is not explicitly defined in the object, look at the prototype object and see what properties it has. And if that one doesn't have it, look at the prototype's prototype. And so on and so forth. The link of prototypes defines a chain of objects. And by default, when you access any property of an object, if it's not explicitly defined in that object, if it's defined in any of the prototypes, it has a value. It's a value whatever the prototype specifies. Now, what happens if you change, but when you change the value of an object, change a property, you only change it in the object. You don't change the prototypes. If you want to change the prototype's value, that you have to explicitly set it.
So like o.prototype.
Exactly. You'd have to say o.prototype. And then, you know, whatever that value. So it's really just defining these are really hash tables. Key value stores. That's what an object is in JavaScript. It's key value stores with a special rule for how to do resolution when a given key is not in that particular one. It's a chain of key value stores. Not in this one, check this one. It's not in this one, check this one. Until you bottom out at the at the top level object. It shadows it.
So it's like overriding.
Exactly. So if you use this as a prototype and there's property one, this new object can define property one for itself. And that will be used in lieu of the prototype's value. But that means you might want to delete the key from an object if you want to see its prototypes, because the prototype is basically its super. Yes. But there's no classes. They're just objects. They're all dynamically definable and dynamically changing. So you have these weird things that you can change properties associated with built-in objects and types. You can even do this, you can redefine how, change the methods associated with integers, with functions. You might kind of go like, whoa, this is crazy. But this is also what makes JavaScript so flexible. You say, oh, that standard type really should have a method like this. Define it. And it does.
So if you go O dot property one and change value two to something else, then the O dot prototype property one, assuming this one, will remain whatever it was before that change. So like it's kind of a local change that you
it's
made.
A prototype is a value of the object.
Right.
When we talk about constructing new objects, what we're really talking about is making a new object, and then you make a new object. You set up the prototype appropriately, and then you would initialize this new instance, whatever you want. Because initially, it'll just be an empty object with a prototype reference. And if you don't want it to have any local state, initially you would have your new your constructor would define those. But by default, it would just inherit everything from the prototype in a read-only fashion.
The question was, if you change the prototype's value, does it override the...
Not if the object has its own version. Because it's... Remember, this overriding thing is simply a result of how the search happens.
Okay.
The JavaScript interpreter goes and says, oh, I want to know what this property value is associated with this object. So I look first in the object's key value store, in its hash table. Does it have that property? If it does, I take that value, I'm done. If it doesn't, go to the prototypes. If that one has it, done. If it doesn't, go to its prototype. Until you bottom out. Yes?
So now with objects, if you want to make multiple of this O object, would you just make a new object with the prototype of this one? Say its prototype is this?
Yeah. Now, but that's what when you say new, that's what you're talking about, is making a new, but remember this new, by default, if you're just sort of constructing an object, what you can do is basically get an empty object with just a prototype referring to it, so it'll get read-only access to all these things. So your new constructor will have to define the properties, but you potentially don't have to do anything unless you have some specific state you want to impart to this, because remember, you just want to change things. You just write to it as needed, and it will override the prototype. Because writes do not go up this chain. Writes just write to this particular key value store. Prototypes is only for reads, not for writes.
When I think about scope changes, is the scheme environment model.
Which most people don't know.
Oh, so we took 3007 and look at it.
Third year, this is the second year class. For those of you who know Scheme, yes, this is exactly what Scheme environments. And in fact, JavaScript objects are basically like the car encoder of a thing, except just extended to arbitrary types. But it's all kind of the same stuff. But it's a really funny way of thinking of objects if you're used to thinking of the world through classes. But you realize this makes perfect sense when you want to make classes dynamic.
So now objects are classes,
there are no classes, right? They're just prototypes.
But do we have instances then? So say I make my O object, and then I want to have 37 different things that are O, but have different values.
Right, so what you do is you have an initial O, and then you have a bunch of objects that refer to it as its prototype. And so they'll get read-only access to it.
Okay.
So you could do this manually. There's a bunch of syntactic sugar in JavaScript, which some of it's more helpful than others. Some of it doesn't quite do exactly what you want, and this is what the good parts is really talking about. But really, it's all syntactic sugar for just a lot. When you're doing these constructor stuff, it's just saying, I'm going to create an empty new object. I'm going to manually assign the prototype to the specific thing that's going to be the prototype. And then I'm going to initialize some other properties.
Can you dynamically generate variable names? Can you dynamically generate variable names?
We can dynamically generate
variables. Like you run a for loop and you actually use the value of the I as the name of this.
Yes. You can do stuff like that in JavaScript. You don't necessarily want to because it potentially involves eval and things like that, but.
And then, so if I give V equals O, what am I doing?
P equals O?
Yeah. Then is P like a reference?
So if I say P equals O, equals changes bindings. It means O and P both refer to the same object. You have not created a new object. They are both referring to the same one. Yes?
So what you're saying is you can type in functions on the command line and attach it to an object?
Yep. Yep, exactly. This is when you're playing with Node. You know that prompt you get? You can type an arbitrary JavaScript and change things. You can inspect the global object and see what properties it has. It's just fully interactive. It's an entire environment.
Okay.
and you can redefine anything.
So
almost.
Make a new P, but then you do like a var P, and then you do the P dot prototype equals O.
No, so to create a new object is you use the object syntax. When you write this, you're defining a new object.
Okay.
So what you would do is, if you want to create a new one, you would just maybe just do two curly braces that, and then you'd have an empty object. You'd say P equals so now you have an empty object, and then you define, you, if you're just doing this manually as opposed to using the syntactic sugar that JavaScript provides, then you'd say you'd manually set the prototype to be whatever object you wanted. You say P dot prototype equals O. So now it has a reference to it. So this is an example of a very simple scheme having very complex semantics, but very powerful semantics. This is the kind of magic you can do in an advanced, you know, dynamic language, and that's what makes JavaScript so powerful. Because in terms of gotchas, what's the one consequence of this? So there is a for in operator. So this lets you loop over all the properties of an object. It loops over all the accessible properties of an object, not just the ones in that object. It goes to the prototype chain. So that means you can get a lot of properties that you don't want. So in general, don't use it. Or if you do use it, you use it and you test for properties that have specific things, or instead, you set up an array with the properties that you want and just loop over those.
Because it actually recurs through the...
Oh, to the whole property chain. So this is where one of those things is kind of like... the dynamic nature kind of gets... I mean, it's useful to be able to do that, because otherwise, how would you access all the properties that you can access?
Just recursive to prototype.
Yeah.
Multiple inheritance?
Multiple inheritance.
Can we have prototypes of two?
Mm-hmm.
Can I have multiple inheritance?
Kind of. You don't have multiple inheritance by default. There's not more than one prototype, but there's lots of ways to merge objects.
Just
copy
paste one.
No. No. Yeah, no. What I'm saying is, because all you have to do is, you basically say, I want to have access to this or this. Your constructor really just has to say, I want these I want to make this object as part of it. It's hard to do. You can't do multiple inheritance through ISA kind of things because it's just one prototype chain. But you can do HAZA type inheritance, but you can have arbitrary numbers of objects as part of this. Yes?
What if you circle the prototypes? It's you have O as a prototype, B as a prototype, Q as a prototype, O.
What happens if you define a circle like that?
Yeah.
I think JavaScript interpreter will notice this and get pissed off. Because it's supposed to be a chain.
Also, at that point, you're setting
object.prototype,
which you shouldn't have
written. Yes. Don't set object.prototype. Well, but you could. No, you could just have two objects that specify each other's prototypes. Yeah,
then
you could do that in principle.
Then,
huh?
And then you for it. You're not
So you can see this dynamic nature gives you the possibilities of lots of things, and you realize, oh, I could do that. And you go like, uh-oh, what would that do? And then you try it, and you go, oh, yeah, it didn't like that. You don't have a compiler behind your back saying, oh, you might not want to do that. There is no compiler. There's just a runtime environment. You type it in there, it does what you ask.
So, and you can pull arbitrary data and then assign it as a property,
mm-hmm.
kind of make JavaScript to see with code, and
right.
So you can dynamically grow code.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah. So this is great for development, because you can say, I want to try out things. Like you dynamically say, let me just see how my object should work. I create this object, I create some, create the object, create some methods for it, say, oh, I didn't make another method, let me just add it in. And then you've got that. And there's actually some ways, like in Node.js, like pull out the stuff that you've entered or something. But it's, you have to have some discipline to what you do. But I just want to make sure I'm answering all the questions I'm supposed to, because I have like 5 minutes. I know. Okay, just 1 second. Yeah, I'll turn them all. Did we just lose the projector? Oh, it's on laptop, that's why. Okay. So, let's go down here. So, let's see the question. Every object in JavaScript has a prototype property. True. The prototype property is used when updating and retrieving an object properties. This is true, false.
False.
So because this one's false because it's only used when retrieving, not when updating. It's read only, not write. In the method invocation pattern, a function returns what value if there's I haven't talked about those. Okay, I think these will move to the next lecture. So I think we've only gotten to 1, 2, and 8. That was one of the reasons I didn't want to do things. So there'll be 3 questions. Maybe we'll add a get one. Well, no, I don't want to get a get one. So we'll just do those 3. So one thing you look actually would be really good is before the next lecture. If you look in chapter 4, it talks about 4 ways of calling functions. I was thinking I was going to have more time today. That's what I wanted to talk about. These, the method, constructor, function, apply, invocation method. So in reading that, what you should realize is that a function is an object. An object can have as any of its properties a function. So when a function is a property of an object, we normally think of it as a method of the object. But there's a little trick here. If you just call the function here, how does it know what object it is part of? It doesn't without certain conventional things. And there's this thing, this is what the method invocation pattern is, a way of specifying, a way of calling a function so that it has a this pointer, which refers to the object for which it is a method. That it gives you all of a sudden, in the scope of the function, this now exists, and this refers to the object for which this is now being used as a method. But since this is, we can slice and dice things, you can also call it just as a regular function. That's when this gets pulled to a global object. You can also call it, and you can also do this constructor invocation, which is where basically the return value becomes this, and the apply a function where you can actually take any function, apply it to any object.
But, was that the closure version when you were?
Kind of. Yeah, we'll talk about this more on Thursday. I'll move the lectures there and the questions there right now. But
so are there still going to be questions today, though?
Yes, there are 3 questions. 1, 2, and 8. I'm editing it right now. What? Okay, number 8 is... Yes, number 8 is true. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so... just 1 second. Sorry, I just need to go back
Yes.
No problem.
So I thought the answer is that CGI should be in a VDI.
Okay, I'm just, hold on. Okay, good. Now I've moved the questions. So I should. Okay, let's just go through. Now you're talking about lecture 3. Which question now?
The quiz.
Yeah, so which of these?
Oh,
Web servers.
So,
oh, right. That allows web servers to call external programs. That is wrong.
Yeah, so for web browsers, it is in the API, right?
Yes. So let me go back and check that. Yeah, that's
okay. He says that the answer should be CGI.
Could, can you send me an email?
No.
Could you send me an email?
All right.
No, always.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.